I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, this is the EFL Freezer Crowd podcast, where we take a light-hearted look at all things Football League.
You scumbaggy maggot, Matt Smith, Troy Parrott.
I'm James, lifelong COV fan, and I'm joined each week by self-proclaimed Statman Luke and resident Millwall fan Andy.
Gary Monk sacked after a 0-0 draw with Millwall as well, although most clubs in the Football League would die for a result like that.
We'll be covering important news, a run through the games, and our all-important goal of the week.
Yes. 3-0 to the own goal.
So find us with a new episode each Monday on Spotify and Apple Podcasts.
You're listening to Acton Millwall, broadcasting from the beautiful South Birmingham. Accept no substitute.
Huge welcome, dear listeners. Welcome to one of our, not quite a lockdown special, because we're not really, we are locked down, but we're not locked down. Welcome to Mr. Neil Crazy Horse Andrews. Welcome, Neil.
Cheers. Hello, Nick. How are you doing?
I'm good, mate. It's a funny old time. No Millwall, but football on, and it's all a bit odd, isn't it? It's Mirinaeum, this is called, this part of the year. Did you know that?
No, I didn't, actually. I think you learn something new every day.
It's the weird hinterland between Christmas, listeners, and New Year. It's that kind of period when nothing's going on, apart from podcasting, clearly, because that's what brings Neil and I together this afternoon. And we're considering the weighty subject, the deep and quite, on one level, simplistic, and on one level, quite complex subject of Millwall's worst ever manager, Neil. It's actually not as simple as it seems, is it?
No, but into context, we are looking at the last 50 years. Before that, it's kind of hearsay, isn't it? So yeah, we've got to give them the fair crack of the whip.
We're going to call it the modern era. And I think one of the first problems you find, if you consider this problem, is that this divides into two methods of assessment, Neil, I found. One is what you might call the strict statistical assessment, which is one method that you can use, because that's just number crunching. But football obviously is not just a mathematical exercise, it's an emotional exercise as well. And that also comes into play in some of the choices and you know, decisions that you make in the end. I'm not sure that you can entirely separate the two, to be honest. I don't know, how did you find the assessment? I found it not as easy as I thought it might be.
Well, there's some obvious candidates, isn't there?
Yes, there are. Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think you've got to put things into context, because I know you posted it on Twitter.
Yeah.
And there was kind of unanimous decision around Peter Anderson, which I don't necessarily agree with, if I'm honest. And then you've got people like Spackman. Yeah. Obviously, people think about Jimmy Nicol, etc. But again, you have to put certain things into context. You've also got to put into the melting pot, you know, the expectations of the managers that came in, their reputation, you know, their what record, they went on to achieve, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, I think my ultimate choice will be a controversial one, but I stand by it.
Well, we're going to hold that up our sleeve, because we like a bit of controversy on this show. And as we're now falling down the ratings of the charts, I think we need to do our best to build up the theatricality of this podcast. So I'm going to save that controversial point till the end of the show, if we may. And I thought we might kick off, having tackled the kind of question, how you assess this. I ran for a few, as you're right, a few obvious candidates, Neil, and a few that I thought would be obvious, but actually weren't. And I'm at the risk of speaking in riddles, I'm going to kick off with the man you've just mentioned, Peter Anderson, because emotionally, and were you going when Anderson was manager, Neil? Well, you'd started when it's Petty, didn't you? So
yeah,
you would have lived the Anderson years along with me.
And well, I started going when it was Gordon Jago, actually.
Okay.
But you know, Petty were the, shall we say, the years that ingrained on my early memories, because obviously the Diego years were, shall we say, for a 4 or 5 year old, you know, you don't take as much in, but you know, as soon as Petty came along, you know, you're reading Shoot, you're reading War of the Rovers, you know, every single player in the Football League kind of thing. It's like you overanalyze everything, don't you?
So it's
kind of like from that point onwards, it's like when you say you really immerse yourself into football. I could be wrong. I'm just speaking for myself, but you know.
Well, I mean, there's two ways you can do this. One is statistically. I just took a very simple view of win rates. You know, so and they're on the Mill History site. There's a fantastic chart of all Mill managers, and it must be Excel based. You can actually arrange them in terms of win rates. So the actual percentage numbers of games won, and that gives you a clue as to the success or not as to the manager. And I've dismissed the kind of short term, you know, there's some caretakers and, you know, very short term arrangements that you can't really take into account. But two things surprised me on that win rate approach. It produces some of the more obvious names, listeners, and we'll come on to those later. But I was expecting to see Peter Anderson with a very low return in terms of actual matches won, Neil, and actually he wasn't. His track record in terms of played 98, won 34 games, drawn 31, and lost only 33. And that's a percentage, if you want to use that way of approaching, of 34%. And that amazed me because emotionally, I've lived a life a bit like, you know, we had a debate about Pat Cuff, Neil, in the worst goalkeeper of all time. And Peter Anderson, for me, emotionally, was the worst manager Mills ever had. Finished up in turmoil, of course, on the brink of Division 4 football, and it was probably a downward slide, but those numbers don't reflect the emotion that I felt. Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, the thing we always talk about Pat Cuff was that his record of clean sheets and the number of games won was equal to Tony Warner, when he won player of the season, which, you know, most people find remarkable, but no, it's better than Tony Warner's, wasn't it? That was the thing.
I think he edged him.
But again, you know, the memory of, you know, a 7-8 year old child is that he was bloody awful. But with Peter Anderson, you know, I think it started off quite well, didn't it? You know, he had a good start where he won 7, drew 8 and only lost 3. And, you know, the club were on the kind of rise. And, you know, when I was reading about it, because he popped up on the Big Match Revisited the other week playing for Luton Town.
Luton, that's right.
Yeah, he was, you know, a bit of a classy midfielder, wasn't he? You know.
He arrived with a reputation, you know.
He did as a decent player. But he said he wanted, you know, his first managerial job to be somewhere like Mill, because he said the only point you could go was up, which he kind of proved wrong.
It disproved the theory, didn't it?
But, you know, he had a decent start, didn't he? You know, I mean, the 81-82 season wasn't exactly terrible compared to...
It wasn't as awful as I remembered it, no.
Yeah, the way Petty ended. But, you know, you've got to remember as well, at that time, we were selling everyone. Yeah, and I think George Petchy, you know, some people would say he was the worst manager, but you know, he was on a hide into nothing, wasn't it? You know, he had to sell John Lyons, Tony Tanner, John Seisman, you know, Kevin O'Callaghan. You know, all these teams had their heart ripped out, all the skillful players went because they're the ones people wanted, and so you got this dour football because that was the only players we had.
Yeah,
I think it was the same with Anderson to begin with, that he had to cut his cloth accordingly. You know, and did quite well at that. You know, he brought in some, I think he brought in Phil Worman, didn't he, from Charlton, who was quite a veteran defender who could add a bit of shape to the back four.
I'm going to have a look at his season now. I'm going to find it on the computer. Yeah, I mean, my memory of Peter Anderson initially, and I found a Daily Mirror column, which I did stick online, which kind of spoke of there was a sense of glamour. You know, he had his playing record was quite interesting. I mean, Hendon isn't terribly glamorous, I will give you that, and neither, to be frank, is Luton. But he was, you know, Luton at that point were a first division side. They were a team noted for playing champagne football, Neil. They played a passing style, you know, unusually for the...
Well, they used to produce a lot of good players. They produced Malcolm McDonald, didn't they?
Futcher brothers, they had.
Yeah. And they had Derek Walker. So, you know, they were always in the spotlight as a result, I think. But, you know, if I recall correctly, he was sold to keep Luton afloat.
Yeah. Sold to Royal Antwerp in Belgium.
Yeah, he went
Belgium.
To Belgium. Yeah, and then he went to the North American Soccer League. Where, you know, you can get some great T-shirts, apparently, for Christmas.
Just don't tumble dry them, Neil.
Just don't tumble dry them. but he ended up, I think, ironically enough, with Tampa Bay Rowdies as well, because that style of football really suited his style of play. And when he came to Millwall, you know, he had some really kind of decent wins to begin with. But then I think the problem was when Alan Fawn replaced Len Epple as chairman. Yeah. Fawn, you know, suddenly said, we don't have to sell anyone, you can start buying players. And I think that's been a problem with Millwall managers down the years, and we'll come on to that later, I think, in that when you're given too much money to buy, you end up buying too many square pegs and trying to put them into round holes. And, you know, he bought Alan West, Sam Allardyce, Trevor Ayloff, Steve Neal, you know, and Trevor Ayloff record signing kind of thing. And it just didn't work. I mean, even Sam Allardyce didn't work in the back four, really.
No.
But then he was quite unlucky. You know, we lost Chris Guffrey. I think it wasn't John Mitchell to injury.
Mitchell was a good strikers. Player.
Yeah. You know, and I read on Twitter when you posted it that people saying that, you know, he didn't really make the most of the youngsters at the time. But all the decent youngsters, yeah, there was still a few about. Mm. But the ones coming up behind the youth team winners weren't that great. I mean, he gave Keith Stevens his debut. But, you know, you look at that side, I think it was only Keith Stevens, maybe Alan McCleary came out at that time. And obviously Teddy Sheringham had the odd spell. But it wasn't like... Well, he had the same problem as George Petchin when he had to play the youngsters, but the youngsters coming through weren't as good as they once were. You know, not saying they're rubbish, but you also got to put it into context of this is third division football in the 1980s, you know, early 1980s.
A tough, hard environment. Yeah.
You know, where, you know, people would try and break your neck or break your legs, you know, just to try and win the ball. And, you know, an 18-year-old, 17-year-old in that environment can quickly crumble and lose their way, I think. So it's a bit unlucky, a bit unfortunate. But then obviously... you know, just reading up, you know, he had a good run where, you know, it's like three wins on the bounce because 3 points for a win then saw Millwall climb up to third. And then came the 6-1 defeat against Grimsby.
Is the dog disagreeing with Anderson?
Yeah, you may want to cut it there. You may want to come back to that one. I should have warned you that this happens when I'm on Zoom calls for work as well.
I mean, just looking at the Anderson's record, I mean, obviously, as you say, I mean, the 80-81 season, we finished 16th, but that was his first full season in charge after taking over from George Petchy, who anyone of that age will remember the slogan all round Bermondsey, Petchy must go, which is hard on him actually, because Petchy wasn't as bad a manager as he became. So, strange way of saying it, mangling the English language. 81-82, we finished ninth in third division. Average crowds of 4,600, so that probably gives you a clue of a sense of depression, Neil. And I was thinking about this before we came on air, because that season there, 81-82, was roughly about 10 years after me starting to go. I started in the early 70s. So that decade, which would take me from the age of about 11 through my teens into my early 20s, when, you know, let's be honest, listeners, your world starts to expand. You have interests that may take you not necessarily to football on a Saturday afternoon. You know, you start to, it had been a decade of decline. We were in the third division and we were playing some poor football, let's be up front. And it was a depressing time because it just seemed like the Millwall was losing in the grand game of called football. We were falling behind. And yeah. I don't think, did you have that? There was a personal sense. So I don't, you know, others might disagree with it, but that was my take on it. You know.
Yeah, I remember the crowds being very low. I think I mentioned this once before. I always remember, you know, at the very low point going to Millwall, you know, around that time. I think it was actually in the Petchy era. We lost 1-0 to Bury.
Yeah.
And I just remember my dad shouting at the top of his voice, "You're going down, Bury." And he was actually right. We lost 1-0. They went down. But that kind of echoed around an empty den. And, you know,
no consolation.
Kind of, you know, as a young boy, it made me laugh quite a lot, actually. But, you know, it was quite, but you could walk, you know, they had the fences, but, you know, you could actually walk from one end to the other.
One end, yeah, that's the old stadium.
At half time, yeah. And, you know, to see the attacking end in the hope of seeing a goal, I think the optimism, you know, the hope that kills you, isn't it?
Absolutely.
But I do remember that Anderson's teams did, you know, kind of, I know in the book Lions of the South, Jim Murray said, you know, it's kind of like exhibition football, which I think goes back to his NASL days.
Where the American
scene. Was kind of different, And we lost a bit of character. We became a bit of a soft touch, didn't we? You know, we would play teams off the park for 90 minutes and lose by a last-minute goal. But I think he didn't have much luck with injuries. As I said, didn't think the, you know, the youth team coming through was good. And I think there was just more expectation because all of a sudden we started buying players. And as you know, with, you know, things like even, you know, Mick McCarthy, you know, you think of Spackman, you know, when you start buying players and you've got money to buy players, it never really works because it's the old thing of not giving the team time to gel.
We haven't done that very well at Mill. We've never been a team that seems to invest wisely. This isn't just now, listeners. It goes back, as you can hear, a long, long time. I don't know why that would be. Someone else will have to analyse that. But I'm just looking at the 82-83 season was really the end of it for Peter Anderson. We'd had some moderate seasons, I think, the best way you can put it, in the third division under his 2 years so far in charge of the club. But the wheels would come off in 82-83, Neil, and, you know, form went down the pan. He would actually leave, I think he was suspended. I found a great, which I've forgotten, a great paragraph from the Daily Mirror saying he was suspended before the Walsall game, which was
it was like, because I said the 6-1 defeat at Grimsby in the cup, everyone remembers that, and he's first 45 minutes of his football career, but he was suspended because Thorne saw that he had dropped Aylott and Allardyce and I think Dean Neil from the team to play that game because they're all carrying injuries and he didn't want to, obviously, for them to break down and lose them for a lot longer.
Yeah.
Thorne said, you know, you can't keep, you know, your two big signings on the bench.
On the bench, kind of
And he kind of got involved a bit like Theo did, the Thetis, you know.
Yeah, he was a medal, wasn't he?
Yeah. And, you know, to be honest, I don't think, you know, he wanted, you know, I think he was doing it for the best. He wasn't trying to destroy me all at all. I think he was, you know, wanted success. But when he got the money to buy new players, you know, he bought Willie Carr in, and apparently Willie Carr was on more than the youngsters. But you would expect that because Willie Carr was an international, quite a renowned character
in his day. But,
you know, he was looking to mix that blend of youth with kind of veterans, and it didn't really work. Whether it's a case of, you know, and again, he didn't have luck with injuries either, but
he
was missing pieces of the puzzle. You know, he was missing a right winger, etc., and that kind of thing. You know, and sometimes it just doesn't work, and, you know, things go wrong.
He would have been missing some front teeth by the end of his time at the Coldblow Lane, if you're anywhere near the blokes that used to shout things.
Yeah,
towards the end of his tenure. I mean, just looking at the league table as his period finished. There we are in 18th, 19th position, 20th of the third division, and we would get lower and lower. Yeah, I mean, George Graham would come in after Peter Anderson and prove in time to be one of the all-time greats. And yet you wouldn't have known that as that season, 82-83, seemed to be heading forever towards disaster and relegation to Division 4, but that would come good. So we're weighing up the worst of all time here, but sometimes I think you're right, Neil. Luck and circumstances and injuries and all the kind of fates, if you want to call it, can play their part. And a bit of patience sometimes from a board of directors because, you know, it was a miracle saviour at the end of that season, but we don't know how that would have worked out for Jules Graham if we'd have gone down. It might not have been quite the same story. Don't know. So that's Peter Anderson. So he was one of my emotional choices. The statistics slightly belie his you know, the real kind of effect of him, although he did take us to the brink of Division 4. So I want to keep you, listeners, keep that in mind, if you will. Another emotional choice, Neil, was Jimmy Nicol in 96 to 97. Again, managing in very difficult circumstances. I slightly eliminated him from my thinking for that reason, that it was not an easy situation to come into. But he didn't exactly help that all hard situation, Jimmy Nicol.
No, and, you know, again, you've got to kind of put into context, you've got to look at what they achieved and what he achieved with Raith Rovers. You know, he deserved a chance. You know, he'd done a minor miracle, Raith Rovers. And, you know, the players he brought in, you know, I know people go on about Jason Dare and, you know, Sinclair being absolutely awful, I'll tell you what, we've had some worse players recently.
We've had a lot worse. And Paul, yeah. I think Paul Hartley up front, I think that was a Jimmy.
Paul Hartley on the wing and Steve Crawford. Steve Crawford was the first striker at Millwall to hit double figures, I think, for about six seasons.
Yeah.
Which says an awful lot about the quality of strikers we had at Millwall before then. But, you know, it just, again, doesn't work. But you got to, again, put it into context in that what was happening at Millwall at the time, you can't really blame.
Not Jimmy Nicol. Very experienced player, 577 Football League appearances, 20 goals for Manchester United, plus a range of others. He'd managed in Scotland, as I think he took Rafe into European competition, which was...
He did.
Which was unheard of.
He won the Coca-Cola League Cup up there, didn't he? So,
yeah, that's right. And you know, it was, they were a team that just never featured in, you know, in terms of success in Scotland or anywhere else for that matter. And to be honest, I mean, his win percentage, he managed for 48 games, won 16, drew 11, lost 21, and was sacked in February 1997 by Theo. I think John Doherty took over briefly to no great effect again. But I mean, 33% win rate, if that's how you want to judge it, which is, you know, one way you can look at it.
Again, it doesn't really put in context because, you know.
No.
His first, well, when he arrived, you know, it was that dreadful season when we were just on downward spiral, wasn't it, playing-wise?
We were broke, weren't we? We were skint. The club was busted.
Well, it wasn't even that. It was like we relied too much on Alex Ray, didn't we? We'd become a one-man team, and when Ray wasn't firing, Millwall weren't firing. We had, you know, the Russians were there, Fuchs was there.
Yeah,
it was just horrendous. It was a poor time. Yeah. But, you know, when you look at the kind of what was the second division then, you know, we made a very good start. I know we got locked out of the league, but, you know, people forget we were top. Then we lost that game to Wickham, who were bombing at the time.
Yeah, just looking
again, a late goal. Late goal there, you know, and we should have really won that. And then there was the Woking game. But as soon as we got knocked out of the cup, that's when the administrators were called in, because I think that was the last chance of getting...
Well, that was a chance of revenue.
Yeah. And then he was asked to leave by the administrators. So it wasn't like he was sacked for performances. He was sacked because of money. And I know there's a story that, you know, he was trying to change things and Millwall fans went up to him and said, no, Jimmy, you got to go.
Whether that's legend,
I don't know. But, you know.
I mean, some of the other names on our list, listeners, will never manage a game. But Jimmy Nicol did manage again. He went back to Scotland. Rafe, Calvin Beef, you can argue about the level. I'm not going to get into that. But Hibernian are a reasonable-sized club, Calvin Beef, and he's also caretake at Rangers briefly in 2018. So, you know, he's seen as a man that knows what he's doing. And I think there's a big difference because we just mentioned Peter Anderson. He did not manage in football again. I don't think he did in America. I think he changed direction completely. And
he did. He
went to IT, I believe, didn't he?
He founded a very successful computer company, Bayshore Technologies, I think it was called. It was featured in, I think it was like a Daily Mirror a few years back. It was doing very well. He kind of dot-com millionaire kind of thing. But again, it was, I think, again, he was one of those who tried the hands of management, never worked out, and
moved on.
Just moved on. But, you know, it's just one of those strange things that quite a lot of those that have featured have struggled to find managerial success after failing at Millwall, which is quite ironic, really.
I mean, one more name in my emotional list, and then we'll probably move on to the logical list, I suppose. I don't know where to put that. But it's Billy Bonds. I mean, he had a win rate of 116, drew 13, lost 24, so not a great season. Under some fairly severe financial shackles, Billy Bonds, and he was responsible for bringing in Neil Harris. So it wasn't a great time. I think Lucas Neil kind of came to the fore under Billy Bonds, I believe.
No, he was injured.
Was he?
Neil broke both his legs during that season, so hardly featured.
Did he?
He starred under Nicol. Big things were expected. So this was one of the forgiving things I say about Bonds. Always kind of the wrong choice. But Neil broke his leg. I think it was his left leg. Came back, then broke his right leg after one game.
I forgot that.
But he brought in Richard Sadlier, became permanent player.
Yep.
But when you think we started with Richard Sadlier and Danny Hopton up front, just shows you the constraints he was working under. But, you know, he, like you said, he signed Neil Harris. He also signed Stephen Reid, Paul Eiffel.
Yeah, I think of him as a builder. Some of the
Tim Cahill as well. He signed Tim Cahill, so, and he gave him their debuts as well. So for all the kind of Kenny Browns and the Paul Allens, you know, there's kind of forgiveness there for the foundations he laid for, you know, what came after.
I'm just looking at his opening day. This is a Billy Bond's opening day lineup against Brentford in 1997, and it's a list of names. It's like, is, you know, it's a time machine. Tim Carter's in goal. Kenny Brown, Paul Sturgis, Alan McCleary, Brian Law, Scott Fitzgerald, Paul Allen, Dave Savage, Richard Sadlier, Kim Grant, and Ricky Newman. I mean, that's, it's a measure of what he was working with, Neil, isn't it? You know, it was not going to be an easy season with you know, willing but limited players. I think that's probably the best way to put it. We're seeing Carl Wirt's name in there as well. I mean, you know, this was a different time. And,
I mean, you think about worst players, my God, Paul Sturgis.
So I'm not going to count Billy Bonds. I mean, West Ham legend as a player, 758 appearances in Football League for Charlton and then West Ham, 663 appearances. That's quite something. He managed at the Den for 1 year only, May to May 1997 to 98. Never managed again afterwards, which is interesting. Never, to my knowledge, I don't know if he did anything at West Ham, but never managed. And, you know, you'd have thought he would have done.
He became a bit of a youth coach, didn't he?
Did he? Which I think he was that. It wasn't that bad as a manager.
No, I think that was kind of his strength. But again, you know, it's like the thing I always remember is like his picture in the program every week because had him in shorts and you could see his varicose veins bursting out of his calves. It wasn't a pretty sight.
Comes to us all, Neil. Comes to us all. I'm going to go down my list of percentages. This is how I've assessed my list, dear listeners. And I'm going to dismiss Jack Cock, who managed in 1944, whilst the Second World War was still on, to 1948. Not to no great success, with just a 26.7% win rate. But those circumstances are special. And I do not think you can truly assess Jack Cock, a playing legend, on that basis. So I'm going to move on to my more logical list now. And I think some of these names, Neil, might be familiar to you. Tell me if you've got any others other than the next series of names.
I'll save mine to the end. Mine is controversial.
Okay. Well, my first choice is one Steve Lomas.
I'm going to put in a bit of a defence for Steve Lomas.
Okay.
He was on a hiding to nothing. You know, the fuck off Lomas banner, you know. And I'll tell you what, you've got to put into context, he took Cowden Beef into Europe.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he took Cowden Beef, I think it was Cowden Beef, it was someone's shit like that anyway, but he took them into Europe. So, you know, he definitely had something about him. But just, it was St. Johnstone, not Cowden Beef, I'm sorry. But, you know, taking someone like that into Europe, you know, you've got to put that into context. It's sort of like he definitely, again, not necessarily had something about him, but he definitely had a certain something to have done that, to achieve that, I think.
His reputation, from what I understand, his reputation in Scotland with St Johnstone was that he played the ball, a fast game, the ball zipping around. I seem to remember him saying something along those lines in his pre-season interviews. He wanted the ball to be zipping around, and that sounded good to me. I agree with you that he's defence of Steve Lomas, in that he was always going to be up against it because of the nature of the tribal nature of the game and the fact that he was this West Ham legend. In his defence, and you know, the members of the jury may or may not want to take into account a free winning game streak where we beat Blackpool at home 3-1, we beat Charlton away 1-0, and then Leeds at home 2-0, with goals from Martin Wolford and Scott Malone. I'll forgive him a lot for that. You know, given some of the company that he's going to be keeping here, I'll forgive him a lot for those three wins. And I think that he wasn't nearly as bad. Although I'm still looking at Smullerings at Birmingham Bournemouth, so
there's a few, yeah, but again, you've got to put something in context. I mean, he had some heavy losses. I mean, we lost 5-1 to Derby, 5-2 to Bournemouth, 4-0 to Watford. But in every single game, we had a player sent off. I mean, Watford, we had Shitty sent off after 10 minutes, you know. And then you look at some of the lineups. Do you remember Guy Moussy?
I remember the name.
Yeah, Sean Derry. You know,
Sean Derry. He just come straight from the pub to me.
Chaplow, like, Bailey. You know, we had. The shit Steve Morrison, which shall we say, and he's saying McDonald, you know, and you know,
yeah,
he had some issues with injury. You know, I'm not saying, you know, he was to blame for some of this stuff. You know, he made the selections, he picked the signs, but you know, he had 5 players sent off in the games he played in a few months.
There's a disciplinary issue which didn't help his cause. He needed to hit the ground running with Millwall because of the West Ham connection. I mean, and I think that's kind of unfair. I know football's, and we've said it already, it's a game of emotion there, wasn't it, rather than a game of statistics, but I always felt unfair.
This is the irony of the situation, isn't it? You know, people will tell Steve Lomas to fuck off. They'll tell Paul Goddard to fuck off. And then go, oh, your 2 favourite Millwall players. Oh, yeah, Terry Urlock and Harry Cripps.
Yeah.
Makes no logic whatsoever. You know, people seem to forget, you know, it's a profession. You know, these people have to earn a living. And if it just happens to be at West Ham, then
so be it.
But, you know, hate them while at West Ham. But, you know, if they then join Millwall, it's sort of like, yeah, I get it. I do get it. You know, that you're a fucking twat. You're a cunt. You should never play for them type of thing. But give them a fair crack of the whip. You know, they score a hat-trick on their first game. You still get a few hating them. But, you know, that's the bizarre logic. That, you know, some of our best players have come from West Ham and even Crystal Palace. And then, you know, you get someone come in with all good intentions who had a good reputation and just gets destroyed because he lost 1-0 at home to Yeovil in the opening game of the season, which was very unlucky as well. But that's the way it goes.
Human nature.
Yeah.
25% win rating for Steve Lomas. We're going to take a swift advertising break and then we're going to hear from Harry Warren and Michael Avery. As an insert to their choices, and then we're going to come back after that break with possibly the biggest pantomime villain in Mill history. So I'll be right back after these messages, dear listeners.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
You're listening to After Millwall.
Hello.
Hello, this is Mark from Beckenham. I saw the Twitter number for the worst Millwall manager of all time. So I just thought I'd give some thoughts. It's definitely between 3 people, Spackman, Lomas and Holloway. I think Spackman was just a poor manager. A bad time. We were going for a big slump, probably well out of depth, I think. With Lomas, again, wrong manager, wrong time. I mean, I remember going to the game against Swansea where we were just playing hoofball. It's probably the worst 90 minutes I've ever seen Mill play. It was, I mean, we played direct anyway, but my God, it was absolutely terrible. And he had no dominant, like, personality. It was just awful. But I've got to give it to Ian Holloway, and the reason why is because he just didn't get the club at all. And I've heard some people talk about Millwall, the identity we've got as a club, and the fans dictate that. You know, we give forward a message of what we want to do. And Neil Harris, you know, had his faults, but he represented that really well. I think Rowett's doing a good job as well, like taking that into the next bit. But Holland, football back's going right up. I mean, we played that massive brief at left back, and he was just awful. Just kept giving the ball away. The identity was completely wrong with our club, and he didn't get it. And he tried to wear that muggy hat that didn't suit him, flat cap, trying to endear himself, but he was just terrible. And I think for that, he has to be the worst manager. Look what he's done at Grimsby now. He's just ran off, and he just didn't get it. So he's got to be the worst manager.
Worst Millwall manager, blimey. There's some contenders there, isn't there? I think you can go with the obvious ones of the Dave Tuttles, the Colin Lees, the Ian Holloways, and the similar. But I mean, even Steve Lomas, I feel slightly. Please don't hate me. Sorry for, because I believe at the time he was the best sort of candidate win ratio for the job. The job he'd done with St Johnstone to get basically was a semi-pro Scottish team into Europe. In consecutive seasons. But for me, the worst manager we ever had was Nigel Spackman. He was just atrocious, wasn't he? He was absolutely appalling. A season after we'd gone down with a whimper, you know, we really, really, really should have had a good clear out and built some good foundations. But when you've got foundations like Lenny Pidgley, Chris Day, Derek McInnes and Philip Moraes, it tells you all you really need to know, really. Didn't work out. Willie Donaghy came in and was the star of a DVD called From Despair to Donaghy. And then the sequel was going to be From Despair to Donaghy Back to Despair, because it was atrocious then as well. But for me, Speckman takes it. Come on, you lines.
So, firstly, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to all the Act on Millwall listeners. Nick's asked us to pick our worst Millwall managers. Now, there have been, in my time of supporting the club, we've sort of been between League One and the Championship, up and down, and a flirt with going to League Two under Nigel Spackman and Colin Lee's role. Now, at the time, these felt monumentally terrible football managers with terrible squads and so on and so forth. However, more recent times, the worst football manager by, and I used to put Dave Tuttle into that. I thought Dave Tuttle, as worst Millwall manager that I've ever seen, could not be beaten until Ian Holloway turned up at the Den. Now, Ian Holloway came with a big reputation and success previously. And was well thought of what he'd done at Blackpool, and also had got Crystal Palace promoted. But obviously, now looking back at it, was a broken man after the way it ended at Crystal Palace. And Millwall took damaged goods. Alan Dunn's autobiography, the promises he made to players and so on and so forth that were broken, a very un-Millwall type of trait. The signing of people like Gary Taylor Fletcher, Ricardo Fuller, Rob Hulse, there's, you know, the destruction of Sid Nelson, making him captain at 19 after a first 11 versus a second 11 game. These are all things that you'd try on the latest version of Football Manager or FIFA. You know, you'd catch a 13-year-old going, why are you playing that bloke who's in defence, it's not going to work. You try and educate them, but clearly this football manager with thousands of games under his belt decided that he wanted self-sabotage as a way. I generally believe halfway through that final season, he was trying to self-sabotage himself, so we'd sack him and he got his payoff. The man is an utter charlatan, and continues to be so, because it's not like he learned anything from the Millwall experience. He got a massive payoff, probably in the millions. Obviously took a job at QPR after us, acted like a complete and utter cunt when Millwall had managed to play. I was away in that away end that night when Gregory was sent off and Millwall were, I think, 1-0 up for a really long period of time before they got a goal late on to get an equaliser, and he celebrated it like he had just lifted the World Cup. But obviously he'd inflamed things further by saying it was Neil Harris that took us down. Now, although that's technically true, when you're 18 points or whatever we were behind teams for Neil to get us, I think we ended up being relegated second game from the end of the season or third game from the end of the season. It was a monumental achievement in itself. I mean, the state he left the club in, the amount of players we had to get rid of on big contracts and so on and so forth, I generally believe has cost us even to this day, really. He continues to be a complete cunt as well by acting the way he did towards Grimsby Town Football Club recently. And yeah, that's just my thoughts on Ian Holloway. The faster the bloke never gets a job again in football. If he's on TV or any description, I just turn it off and turn it over. I've got no reason to listen to him. I know more after I've started doing my coaching badges in the last year. I know more off of one set of FA coaching badges level one than seemingly what Ian Holloway knows after 20 odd years in football. No wonder Vinnie Jones and the crazy gang bullied him out of Wimbledon. And to be honest, good on them. It makes me like the crazy gang more.
If you're enjoying Afton Millwall podcast, then why not help us grow the show and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts? We'd love it, love it, if you visit the Apple link in the show notes and leave us a rating and a review. Achtung Millwall is the number one podcast broadcasting from beautiful South Bermondsey. No show sponsors, no Patreon, and no TikTok accounts. Thank you, dear listeners, and as always, arrivederci Millwall.
Big thank you to Harry and to Michael. We've covered Lomas. In my order of assessment, with a 22.5% win ratio, fighting out of Bristol, Mr. Ian Holloway comes next on my list, Neil. And I think he is a contender for worst manager of all time. And I think you have to include statistics and emotion in that assessment. How do you see Holloway?
I'm going to stick up for him here. I'm not really. He was fucking awful.
64% won't agree with you on my poll online.
He was
awful.
I was at the Norwich game where we lost 6-1. You know,
the away game. Yeah,
me and Stan were there. It was a funny game in that, you know, Millwall were in their best sense of humour, gallows humour type of thing. And when we scored, Stan still remembers it to this day, you know, singing, you know, "You must be shit, we scored a goal," which I think sums up his, you know, yes, he kept us up that first season. My dad actually said, "Oh, I can see him taking us out of this division." Yeah, well, yeah, it'd be the wrong way. And so he was just clueless, absolutely clueless.
Well, that was always that season that we survived. And I think we survived with a few wins at the end of the season to dodge relegation. That's always brought up by Holloway himself in his defence, that he kept us up, and it was Neil Harris that relegated us. But that covers a multitude of sins of, wasteful signings, mismanagement, the Sid Nelson scandal. I think scandal is the right word for it, to plunge that young kid in as captain. Yeah. Many, many, many comments online. I'll read some of them out after the show.
Absolutely, you know, like you said, you've got to judge it on the reputation, where they come in, etc. Big things were expected of him because he had done it elsewhere, you know. And I know he was always seen as this quirky
the West Country.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this kind of very much, you know, a figure, not a figure of fun, but, you know, people used to laugh along with him, laugh rather than that.
Comedic, yeah.
And it was sort of like, you know, after keeping us up, it's like, yeah. Yeah, you were expecting great things, but then, yeah, Harris took us down, but we were down long before that.
We were relegated their minds a long while before he actually went, and he was clinging on for
it. It's sort of like, you know, someone saying, well, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald pulled the trigger. Yeah, Buddy loaded the gun and put the bullets in and gave him the rifle and, you know, told him where to be, kind of thing. It's kind of a ridiculous defence. There was no way he would have kept us up, because that Norwich game, it was so shambolic. It was absolutely shambolic from start to finish. And I've never seen such a shambolic game, except for the, my candidate who I'll get onto later.
Well, we're keeping that one up our sleeve.
And, you know, it was kind of, I think, again, if you look at the reputation, he was not a bad manager. I just think it was the most catastrophic. I can't even speak. Clusterfuck as of an appointment I've ever seen at Millwall. I don't know what went wrong, why it went wrong, what happened, or what was going on, but it just didn't work. And it was like, and I will say, I think Spackman was probably worse than him. You know, Spackman was clueless. Can't even find an excuse for Spackman. You know, you could say that. That Holloway admitted that he came back too soon. He needed a break from football. I kind of do get that. And it was shambolic. Spackman had no excuses. And that's the only thing that would probably save him. Holloway, that is, compared to Spackman. And that Spackman was just utterly idiotic, both on and off the field.
Well, I think as counsel for the prosecution here, I think I would place Holloway above Spackman in that Holloway's pattern, that the pattern with Millwall, this initial sense of promise, and there was, I mean, I fell for it. I won't deny to anyone listening to this show that when he first arrived after Lomas had gone, there was a sense of excitement because he had a track record of success, on at least on the surface, Neil. He'd taken Leicester City upwards, I believe. Blackpool.
He's taken Blackpool in.
He's taken Leicester up. I know he managed there. They were relegated as well. But Blackpool and Palace, he both took into the Premier League. So there was a sense of, you know, there was a glow of success around him. And no one really wanted to mention Plymouth, who he walked away from, you know, after, again, initial. That was his, one of his. The other side of his coin, he comes in and promising the earth, and then will walk away. And Grimsby Town have just found this out quite recently, haven't they? Again, if I was looking at, I can't remember the name of the paper, the Grimsby Examiner or something like that, and they've analysed his career at Grimsby, which again, very, very similar, very, initial promise, and then away he goes when things start to get a bit heavy, blaming everyone and but himself.
Yeah. That's kind of the story of his career, though.
Yeah.
He would have good spells, and he would hit upon a magical formula, but more by accident than luck. And that's what he was trying to do at Millwall, I think, try and find that magical formula. And it just didn't work. And again, you know, you could say that some of the squad was shite. You know, some of the players he brought in weren't the right players for Millwall at the time.
No.
But again, you've got to apportion blame somewhere. And, you know, at the end of the day, if you're not getting results, yes, it's the manager and the players. And once they step over the line, you know, you haven't got a lot to do with that. But if you keep chopping and changing as much as he does and what, you know.
Because I remember there being players passing through like it was Charing Cross Station in rush hour. You know, you there were players you just literally can't remember. You mentioned Moosey earlier on in that way that they just blur out of your head. So let's have a look at the players for 2014 to 15, that goes up to 40. I mean, squad numbers go from one, which was David Ford, all the way up to the low 40s, and that's with a number of players sharing shirts over the course of the season. And you know, you've got some names in there again that just part. I mean, Justin Hoyt's in there. I mean, he existed in the kind of collective memory, didn't they? Scott McDonald.
Hell was Dan Harding?
Well, this is it. I mean, Taylor Fletcher, I mean, we remember him for an Angel Martinez and
20 games, Dan Harding. The hell is he? I don't even remember him.
Nicky Bailey, you know, he's nondescript.
I remember Nicky Bailey.
I remember him, but I mean, I don't want to remember him, but these nondescript players that, passed through our club. And I think that's the unforgivable, because you have to. If it had been one of the, let's say it was a Spackman and he'd been given more time, and a Spackman had produced a season of 40 or 50 players with disastrous results, you could say, okay, he was the architect of it all. But Holloway came to us with this reputation for managing at the top flight, in the top flight. And that's what I find so unforgivable with him, because he must have known what he was doing. He must have known the chaos he was creating, and he did it anyway. And that I can't forgive. It's summed up by the Sid Nelson, the Sid Nelson scandal when he made an 18-year-old Millwall fan. We all know the Sid story, and we will, you know, a lot of time for Sid. But young boy made club captain because he thought it would curry favour and take some of the heat off of him as manager. That's low rent, I think.
Well, people say that, but you know, Ray Wilkins was made manager at Chelsea in similar circumstances. Look what happened there. So I don't necessarily buy into that one, you know, throwing Sid under the bus kind of thing. No. You know, it's kind of, you know, Ray Wilkins is a good case in point. You know, Chelsea were really shy at the time, which some listeners may not remember.
No.
You know, and they put someone in who came through the ranks, and, you know, it kind of worked. And I kind of got the intention behind it that, you know, you had this Millwall kid through and through, you know, who's gonna, you know, fight.
He was seen as the next big thing, wasn't he?
Yeah. But you know, at the rest, who else are you gonna make captain? You know, Dan Hardy,
Josh Hooivelt,
Ed Upson. Yeah,
Ed Upson is a name. So Ian Holloway managed Millwall January 2014 to March 2015, where he was clinging on by the end for his pay. Incidentally, I in a similar way, and I'm probably gonna inspire a lot of people to scream at their car stereos now or into their headphones. He clung on for his payout because he didn't want to walk away because it meant that he wouldn't get paid. Now, I don't entirely blame him for that because it is, you know, you said it earlier on, it's a job. You know, if you could be paid money from a place of employment, you would do your best to achieve that. And, you know, there were many things that Ian Holloway did wrong, and I don't blame him for clinging on for the best payout he could achieve for himself, in all honesty. That some people might say that's
I actually agree. Yeah, I agree with that. That you've got to take the emotion away, haven't you?
It's an employment.
And if anyone else in a similar situation, they would wait for the payoff.
It's only because we sentimentalise football in a way as fans, and that's what we do. That's the romance of the game. But in the end, it's from a professional point of view, it's a place of employment. So you know, if you
at the end of the day, the club signed the contract. So, you know.
Club signed the contract. And it's called a contract for a reason, and it's an agreement. So that bit, although he got hammered for it and gets hammered for it, it's still online. I don't entirely take away his right to get the best deal he possibly could. So Ian Holloway played 62, won 14, drew 19, lost 29, scored 55 goals. This is probably the worst part of it, Neil, against 94 goals against. So for every goal we scored, we conceded nearly two, 22.5% win ratio. So I think he's my candidate for worst of all time, but I do have a couple of, well, three more turkeys to go through with you before we can come to your controversial choice. And maybe, I don't know if I'm going to come to any, tell me if any of these are your choices now, but next up with a brief period, 6 month period, Colin Lee. In a season of utter turmoil at the Den. There may be kids now that don't remember this because it, I think our listenership is almost all 25 to 55 year old blokes. So I think they probably all will remember this season all too well.
You've got to diverse a bit more. You've got diverse.
Apparently,
You've got to get out there.
I've got to get on TikTok, listeners. I don't know how I'm going to tell that story on TikTok. 2005,
6. Yeah, Colin Lee was one of those managers that it was. We had more chairmen than managers that season.
Had as many chairmen as managers. That was when Theo departed. Wise had gone the previous season, which was it was the European season, wasn't the cup final season?
European season. Yeah, it was. Again, that was when they sacked Claridge, wasn't it?
Claridge was manager for July.
He just knew that was going to end in defeat. Relegation rather. But you know, it's kind of. It was a great manager for a great period is the best way you can sum that up.
I think, Colin Lee came in. I remember Colin Lee once scoring four goals for Tottenham. He wasn't a player that ever really impressed you, but somehow I think they beat Bristol Rovers 9-0 in the 70s and Colin Lee got four goals.
I remember Colin Lee from Shute and Royal Rovers, that kind of thing.
And he played for Chelsea, you know, a reasonably experienced player. He'd had some management experience, Watford, Wolves, Torquay, Walsall, and then Millwall. Strangely, never again after Millwall. So, you know, this is going to be a repeat theme now, listeners.
I think that was always going to be the last saloon for him anyway. You know, He was never a manager that would be first on anyone's shopping list.
He was cast in the role. I mean, we had the Steve Claridge interview, obviously, in the summertime, which was utterly fascinating. If you haven't listened to it, do. It's an insight into the psyche of Steve Claridge. I think Colin Lee at the time, and also if you listen to Claridge's interview, rightly or wrongly, fairly or unfairly, was cast as a slight pantomime villain, like they're kind of lurking in the wings, waiting to come on and take your job off you, like the child catcher in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, you know, yeah. That kind of air about him. But whether that's fair or not, I don't know.
But then, you know, who brought him in? It was Steve Claridge.
Was he assistant to Claridge?
He was assistant to Claridge, yeah.
Okay. It's almost Shakespearean, isn't it?
Whether he brought him or whether it was forced on him, I don't know. So giving the benefit of the doubt, but.
This is when Theo was still pulling strings from
Colin Lee, if you were to say Colin Lee was a country, you called him something like Communist Poland.
Communist Poland Lee.
Communist Poland or Communist East Germany, dour, grey, functional.
Barely functional, games. Barely yeah. functional. I think you probably are capturing something with that idea of Poland under communism. Mm. Because it barely worked. Just about. He played 28, or managed 28 games. He won just 6 times, drew 9, lost 13. 426 against 42. So actually not far short of the score one that concede 2 ratio that we had with Ian Holloway, actually. That was in 2000, July to December 2005. Then he became director of football. Do you remember that bizarre period when he went upstairs to become director of football? Like a Bermondsey Rhinus Michels or something, sitting up there, you know, wanting the it beautiful...
like being head of Stasi in Poland to becoming head of Stasi in East Germany.
Achtung, Mehlball. Colin Lee, 21.4% win ratio. He doesn't make the cut for the absolute worst, but he's certainly in the relegation zone. I have 2 more for you, dear listeners. Next up is, what should we call that? It was a Kalahari desert of a period of Millwall history. We have Dave Tuttle up next. You've had enough of Colin Lee. You've now got him as director of football, directing the footballing genius that is David Tuttle from December 2005 to April 2006.
He's the Albania of football. Best way you could describe it. It's just
I used to feel sorry for him, and I don't know why do I feel sorry for him? Because he's just pitying me.
I remember he got a lot of flack when he... who did he replace in the centre of defence?
It was a Sean Dyche, wasn't it? It was in that.
He replaced Nevercott, I think, and we lost a few, and he took the blame.
He had a decent free kick on him. Yeah, he had a striker free kick.
Because he played for Palace, I think that was it. I know Stephen Constantine mentioned, you know, his way, you know, his tactical talk was to bring in a load of alcohol to tell the players to get drunk. And that kind of thing, like Brian Clough. But again, it was more of a caretaker role, wasn't it, with Burns? So I don't think we can really include him in the list.
No, he was awful. Mm. And we were sliding towards relegation and oblivion. He won just 18% of his games, if you want to assess it. He managed 22 matches for Millwall, winning just 4 times, drawing 9, losing 9. His for and against numbers weren't too bad. They scored 16 and conceded 23. So
it's like making a purse out of a sow's ear, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, we're only just losing. We're still losing, but only just.
You've got to give him the benefit of the doubt, I think.
All right. Well, there we are. That's David Tuttle. And finally, listeners on my list is, and I don't know if this is your big reveal, Neil, or whether that's so, it's going to be Nigel Spackman from May to September 2006. He managed just 12 games in charge and won 2, drew 2 and lost 8. We scored 8 goals in that period and conceded 21.
He was so out of his depth. Was it he said, you know, I'm doing all the right things on the training ground, but I'm not doing it in the matches, you know, but, you know, If it means I've just got to go out and grind results, you know, to keep my job, then that's what I do.
Well, that would have been lovely if he could have done that. That would have been lovely.
You really don't get it, do you? It's kind of, he was more of a coach, wasn't he? He wanted to play silky football. But again, he hadn't managed for a while. He hadn't really had a good track record. I think he was cheap, which is why we got him.
Always a big factor.
But again, it was like during that almost second spell in administration, wasn't it, after Theo fuck up. And we got in all these players, most of them signed on a free, and apart from Richard Shaw, most of them were terrible. Hackett was all right, actually. But, you know, the rest of them, you know, Philip Moraes, I know he had a decent career elsewhere, but he was a bit lightweight. You know, we had... we had some horrendous people come in, didn't we?
Well, just looking at opening day fixture, I mean, it's sometimes worth just savouring these names. This was Nigel Spackman's first game in charge. At home to Yeovil, blindingly hot day. I remember it well. I remember Heather Rabatz handing out water to the ticket queue because they couldn't organise the ticket. They should have signed someone for the ticket office rather than some of these players. But the number, so the goalkeeper, number one, Lenny Pidgley. Morris Ross, Tony Craig, old long-time servant, Marvin Elliott, Richard Shaw, not Paul Shaw, Zach Whitbread, Marvin Williams, Derek McInnes went on to some managerial success in Scotland, Neil, didn't he? Was it Hearts, I believe?
Dunfermline, I thought it was.
Dunfermline. Yeah. So he's become a name in management terms.
Yeah.
North of the board. Tam Brighton. Darren Byfield and Philippe Murray, and then on the bench we've got Day. Who was Day? That was
goalkeeper.
Yeah, I can't remember his first name. Day, goalkeeper, spare goalkeeper. Paul Robinson, Neil Ardley, Chris Hackett was all right, and Paul Huberts was. I didn't mind Paul Huberts. I mean, that wasn't the worst 11 in the world.
But yeah, it was Chris Day, by the way. Yeah, it wasn't. But Huberts was that meaty striker who didn't get a fair crack of the whip. Under Spackman, we had Kevin Braniff start a few times. McInnes is McInnes was a decent midfielder, but he used to train alone in Scotland, then fly down for the games. And he used to put a shift in. And Tam Brighton got injured. I know Byfield didn't really work out, but even with that team of players, you would expect to get results. I mean, Ross was a Scottish international. And that group of players, with Lenny Pidgley, who was at the time highly rated in goal, under a different manager, they probably would have done quite well in that division. But
probably should have done okay. Yeah. I think it comes back to the manager. I think you're right. Chopping and changing, I mean, you know, again, I know you have to react to events, but there's always some value in at least having a basis of a starting 11. You need the old classic spine, and he was chopping and changing, I suppose, but panic set in. I remember I met Spackman in the executive lounge. It must have been a pre-season friendly. It was a very, very hot day. He was kind of doing the handshaking in the exec lounge. It must have been a friendly or something. And yeah, I'm a great believer in its first impressions. You have like 10 seconds to actually assess somebody when you meet them. And in general, that's correct, that assessment, whatever that might be. And I can't remember what he made some remark about the players of the previous season needing to liven up or something. It just seemed a little bit like opening up the bathroom door and looking in. You know, it just didn't seem right. You shouldn't be doing that as a manager. You know, there's a certain need in this world for loyalty amongst your group, and he didn't show it. And I remember then having doubts, and it was just unsettling, you know, one of those things that nags at you. It just seemed he was wearing like slip-on slider type sandals as well, which didn't, I don't know. So I don't know, I think he is my choice, Neil Andrews, Nigel Spackman, because he had an okay playing record. He played for Liverpool.
Played for Chelsea, played for Rangers.
And had some management experience, not a brilliant track record in management, but he must have known the ropes. But we seem to be signing players for fun. It was almost if you were walking past the ground outside in the street, you could just like walk in and get a job. It was very, very odd. I mean, again, 35, the squad goes from none to 35. Players, I can't remember, Charlie Lee. Do you remember Charlie Lee? I don't remember him. Do you remember him? I don't remember him. I mean, Jody Morris came in. This would be later in the season. But what Spackman started, was a season of turmoil. And, you know, I think he was replaced by Willie Donoghue, who actually saved the day that season, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And then he had his 16 strong men, big and strong and true, whatever he called them. And it didn't work the following season. But, you know, he was unlucky, I think. If he had that team, well, he did have that team, but if he was able to build in that team, because I know he lost a few players at the end of that season, he could have built something good at Millwall. I think, you know, he, again, just had a bad run of, you know, throw the dice, as it were, in terms of players leaving and not having the money to sign new players and having to kind of work with a squad that didn't really work. And then obviously Jacket came in and
the rest is history.
Yeah.
I mean, Spackman left us with a sitting 23rd, maybe 22nd, depending on which day. But there we are, 23rd in division, the third tier, League One at that point. Staring at the relegation, really, and I think that would have been the logical conclusion of Nigel Spackman's season. So I've combined statistics and emotion to produce my worst of all time, my WOT, which is Nigel Spackman. Are you going to do your reveal now? Do I need to do a bit of an orchestral finale type thing for your big reveal, worst of all time?
If you've got an orchestra, Andy, in your living room.
I can produce a lot of things, and I'll do that again.
Well, you know, you can always overdub it, can't you? And then pretend that you're doing this big orchestral reveal.
Destroy the mystery.
Yeah. Mine is purely emotional. And actually, I'm going to focus on a certain number of results as well, which changed the course of Millwall history.
Okay.
And my nomination for worst manager of all time is none other than Mick McCarthy.
That's actually a very interesting choice, because I don't think I can disagree with that. I know what you mean. I know what you mean. It's an interesting.
There's reasons behind it, and I know there's a few people saying, "Well, you know, we beat Arsenal and Chelsea,
the cup run." Yeah.
And I totally agree. He had his moments, but I think he flattered to deceive, and I think he is flattered to deceive throughout his career in every job he's gone at. But if we just stick to Millwall, he changed the formation to the diamond formation. And, you know, that season we played some lovely football and we were beating teams off the park, and yet we didn't make the playoffs. And you got to ask,
that'd be 92-93.
And he got quite lucky. He bought Andy May, who, you know, was the linchpin of this formation. He inherited Casey Keller.
He inherited a great squad from Bruce Rioch.
He did. And that team really should have made the playoffs. They should have gone up, and they didn't. But people said, "Oh, but we played lovely football," but we still missed out on the playoffs. And the following season, the first season at the New Den, again he had a good quality team. We had Etienne Verveer, you know, firing. We had, you know, decent players. We lost Colin Cooper, admittedly, you know, who was a linchpin of that side as well. And he got us into the playoffs. And we said he got us into the playoffs. He should have took us up straight away that season. Forget the playoffs. We had a team there that should have been promoted. And for whatever reason, they weren't. He brought in Terry Hurlock, which, again, I know people, yeah, saw it
as an emotional pull with Terry.
Return of the prodigal son. Yeah. But again, got sent off for his first game, etc. You know, it was like Man City signing Rodney Marsh when they were on course for the title and then lost it, because it changed the dynamic. And I know it's an emotive, and I know people argue against me, and, you know, they're welcome to their opinion kind of thing. But, you know, he got sent off after 8 minutes for kicking someone. And we drew that game we should have won, you know, 0-0. We drew it with nine men. I know Vandenhaal got sent off as well. But it kind of set the tone for the rest of the season. And then, you know, you go into the playoffs. You've been playing 4-4-2 all season. So what does he do away to Derby? He plays 3-5-2 and we lose 2-0.
Yeah.
You know, forget about the return game, which was just a fuck up from start to finish. But that 3-5-2 against a team would, you know, I think we'd beaten it quite easily a couple of weeks before. You know,
we beat them 3-0, I think. We beat it decisively. Yeah,
and we're, you know, we shouldn't have been in the playoffs anyway. And so
it's an interesting choice. I'm just thinking about it. Yeah, go on.
But then you sort of go on the following season. You know, you get the two cup runs, so you get to the quarterfinals of the League Cup, fifth round of the FA Cup. I know you can't do anything about Damien Webber handballing it against QPR, but that game against Swindon, again, we lose 3-1 against the team we'd beaten quite comfortably a few weeks previously. You know, missed out on a semi-final. It was ridiculous. And we did nothing in the league that year. absolutely nothing. You know, he signed Kingsley Black, you know, a very decent winger.
Yeah.
Played in one game, then changed the formation to 4-3-3. And he would do that throughout his career. And then the following season, you know, he bought, you know, we sold Roberts and we bought, yeah, Uwe Fuchs. We'll get on to him in a minute. But he bought, what was it, six different players. And, you know, he changed the squad. He then brought the Russians in. And it's like, it just was, it's like Peter Anderson. Too much money. And he's buying wrong players, Ricky Newman and Bobby Bowery, who are, yeah, I know this has annoyed people. They are decent players in their day. They will fit in a certain side. They just wouldn't fit into Millwall's side and, you know, where they come from, etc. But he bought, you know, he spent half a million on Gerard Lavin. And it's like, why are we spending half a million on a right back? And then he played against, you know, we went on this 10-game unbroken, you know, unbeaten run. And the game against Stoke where we lost, I always remember this, we had a left back playing at centre half. So tell a lie. We had a centre half, as in Ben Fatu wanted to play left back because he thought he was Stuart Pearce playing left back. We had a left back in Van Blerk playing left wing. We had Ricky Newman, a right midfield, playing right back, and Gerard Lavin, the right back, playing right midfield. I was thinking, what the fuck are you doing?
Well, so the word leaps into my mind, and actually, it leaps into my mind when you consider the departure of Mick McCarthy is unprofessional, because for at least 6 months of that very odd season where we were relegated, or 6 months of the first part of the season, shall we say, we were looking okay. We somehow scrambled to the top of the table. But all that time, his eyes were on the Republic of Ireland job, because Jack Charlton was on the brink of resigning or being sacked or whatever.
Yeah, but even Uwe Fuchs, you know, he had a great spell at Middlesbrough, where people say he could flatter to deceive, but he came in. And apparently, he just put the piss out of him in the dressing room all the time. And demoralised players. I knew someone who knew Stephen Forbes, the midfielder, who was and he was saying, you know, that Fuchs would just sit in the changing room and it just rip into him, and, you know, calling him all the names under the sun, you know, and what have you. It's kind of like his motivational piece. It just didn't work.
You're really going to play for someone after
that. Well, some of the dross he signed: Richard Hapsford, Lee Luscombe, Lee McRobert, or as I knew him, Lee McShit. You know, and it's like, and he would sell players and just sign dross, and he, you know, he tried to rebuild teams without even replacing it. And we were so reliant on Alex Ray that as soon as you took Alex Ray out the side,
we were lost.
We were just an awful side in flats. That season we went down, our highest record win was 2-0. You know, this was meant to be this great. We were nicking results left, right and centre. And I'll tell you what, he's gone on. Everyone says about Republic of Ireland. Again, loads of great players, but...
Well, Roy Keane really didn't think highly of him there, did he?
Exactly. I mean, you know, Roy Keane summed it up, I think, that only Mick McCarthy could take a World Cup squad, and their training ground was a bit of rough patch around the back of the hotel. It's kind of, you know, and he's done that. Yeah, actually, one of the best things he ever did as Millwall manager was taking Kevin Kyle off, I think it was, for Sunderland, after he threatened to score to equalise in the semi-final. For some reason, he took him off.
He did that, yeah. So that was his great gift to Millwall.
That was his great gift to Millwall, but... You know, I would say until my dying day, he was one of the worst managers ever, because with that squad he had, with the money he had to spend, and don't forget, this is where we end up in administration as well, and the wages he was paying out, so the dross he was actually serving up in terms of players and football at times, you know, it was kind of ridiculous. And I know we beat Arsenal, and I know we beat Chelsea, you know, but even the Arsenal, you look at the team there, Ali Edwards up front, you know, and Ali Edwards was unlucky in that game, to be fair. But, you know, David Mitchell was huffing and puffing even then. And the Arsenal were just so poor. I think we kind of got away with, although we did play well that night. We played really well that night. We played well against Chelsea. But it was kind of, we played well sporadically under Mick McCarthy. And we would have good runs. Whether it was because of him or in spite of him, I don't know.
Interesting choice. Now, I'm just as a, to close it, I mean, just looking at the sendings off, I've never really looked at this before, but under Mick McCarthy, we had 8 sendings off. And this is the season we went to the playoffs, 93-94, 8 sendings off in the course of that season, 5 sendings off, 94-95, and then he didn't complete 95-96, but 7 with, you know, I know you can't avoid yellows in the modern game, but there's a certain lack of discipline to keep getting reds. And it kind of keeps taking you back to that sense of almost an unprofessional kind of attitude, or the couldn't care less kind of attitude.
Those kind of red cards, it cost you. I mean, it's a good point. I think the under Keith Stevens and McCleary, who once had 12 sent off in a season.
Yeah.
But that was some really weird decisions. And we were still carving out games and we're still winning games, you know. But, you know, it was sometimes it was, you know, for dissent and things that you could crack down. And other times
two yellows, just, you can get that. I think it does cost you over course. You're playing repeatedly with 10 men or, you know, hopefully not less, but, you know, it can certainly cost you. So it's an interesting point. It's an interesting choice, Neil. It wasn't what I was expecting, to be honest, but an interesting choice. I'm trying to think. I kind of get where you're going with it. It just seems harsh to throw him in the same
boat as Ian Holloway. The season we went down, Casey Keller went to some, I think it was the CONCACAF tournament.
Yeah.
You know, got picked by America and people saying you shouldn't let him go and what have you. But this is, you know, a big thing for Casey Keller. You know, you play against Brazil and that kind of thing. He came back. And so to show him who was boss, he put him on the bench and kept him Carr in goal. And I think we lost that game.
Yeah.
You know, and then following week, Keller was back. It's like, if you've got Casey Keller available, why the hell are you playing Tim Carr? You know, as much as, you know, I like Tim Carr as a person, you know, God rest his soul and what have you. If you had a choice between putting Tim Carr and Casey Keller in goal and you put Tim Carr in goal, there is something wrong with your managerial style and technique and even ability.
There we are. It's all a matter of opinion. I'm just looking at some of the comments on my poll. My poll finished today. 544 people voted for Mill's worst ever manager. 64%, as we've said already, Neil, went for Ian Holloway. Nigel Spackman got a creditable 23%. Tuttle and Colin Lee picked up the also-rans. In the comments, some great comments through here. I mean, Rob Carnaby says Colin Lee was the only manager he'd ever seen confuse the players during a warm-up passing drill 20 minutes before kickoff, and it kind of made him wonder how the rest of the week was going if they're confused there. There's some great other comments here. Holloway says James Gibbons. Holloway almost felt like he was intentionally failing, so he got a payout. I don't know about that. But Diana Day, speaking about Peter Anderson, says he was the worst by country mile, Neil, closely followed by Jules Pecci, Ian Holloway, Lomas and the rest. Anderson spent money on crap players, drove the fan base to 2,300 and the foot of Division 3.
That's not true, actually. The fan base was at 2,500 when he took over and he got a run of results that actually took it back to the 5,000 mark.
He doubled the crowd.
He actually doubled the crowd as a result. But the spending on the crap players, it's like the point we were saying, that suddenly he got money and he brought players in that weren't necessarily crap. That was the thing. So, you know, they just didn't fit Bill Wall. You know, it's kind of...
As I say, emotion plays its part. I mean, naming's Jimmy Nicol.
The players you bring in, you know, you bring in Sam Allardyce, you bring in Trevor Ayler, and you bring in Willie Carr. Now, these are established names. They're not crap players per se, but perhaps it just didn't work at Millwall. You know, that's kind of the thing you've got to remember when you kind of weigh up these, you know, the signings and the crap players kind of thing. You know, it's like Ricardo Fuller was always going to find goals. And then, you know, under Holloway, he was lucky if he could find the bench.
Or find the roof of the stand on one occasion. There we are, dear listeners. I think that's a great way to close it. I think Neil's choice, Mick McCarthy, I think that's going to be a controversial choice. Mine, I think on reflection, I'm going to go with Nigel Spackman, but there's an honourable mention. And the people's choice was Ian Holloway on 64%. And I won't fight anyone who says Ian Holloway, to be absolutely honest.
I would actually agree with Ian Holloway, except Mick McCarthy had so many chances to take us up and blew every single one of them.
You're listening to a man scarred.
I am scarred.
We're all scarred.
I used to laugh when Ireland lost. I used to laugh heavily to the point that when Terry on ball handballed it, you know, it was like, yeah, that was playing Mickey Bennett, you fuckers.
Huge thank you to Neil Crazy Hawks Andrews. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this show, dear listeners. I hope you have your own views and opinions. Do let us know your take on. I mean, a lot of you have done it already on the worst managers. But do let us know if you have any other input for the show. Big thank you, Neil. Thank you for joining me today.
Yes, thank you for having me. And now I'm going to have to go lie down and take some medication, I think.
I still do the same with some alcohol. So thank you for listening, dear listeners. We'll be back very, very, very soon with another edition of Achtung Millwall. Happy Merry Nahum, and Happy New Year, if I don't speak to you before then. Until then, it's bye for now from me and from Neil. Bye for now.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Aston Millwall. If you enjoyed the show, please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a cheeky little review. A river direction, Millwall. Till next time.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.